Vikey, talk about the making of the album, The Seven Sinners. Talk about the making of the record, and you know, talk about the meaning behind the album, where you came up with the song title, where you came up with the actual song titles themselves, where you came up with the actual album title, the album cover, you know, all that stuff. Just talk about the basic concept of the album, The Seven Sinners, and you know, tell the fans what went behind it.
Well, we had a meeting, Darius and me, and I played to him my demos that I would have on an iPhone, and so on the iTunes artwork, I had put the septagram elfin star. It's like a seven-pronged star that I wanted to have, well, to ooze like some good magic while doing the demos and whatever. Eventually, I didn't use it as a desktop background or whatever, but then I put it on the actual demo data that I played to Darius on my iPhone with like a Sony headset. And then he saw that and he kind of liked it, and I said, yeah, we can like put it into the cover somehow, that elfin star. And we had two tracks that went sinner, like Where the Sinners Go and the Sage the Fool the Sinner. And I said, we're not gonna change any of those tracks just because we have sinner twice, right? No. Mm-hmm. And then we put the elfin star on the cover somehow. Yeah, good idea. Magic, nice. Positive magic, by the way. And positive. And then, well, he went, and then, you know, well, seven prong, why not seven sinners? Seven keys, whatever, seven sinners. Mm-hmm. Said, yeah, that's the album title. And then during the recordings, we had a few things different from usual, like, well, we recorded more or less without drum click, without clicks for, so Dennis' natural feeling of timing and everything was taken. And we put MIDI events in the editor in order to arrange stuff later on, like keyboards and everything else, because you're in the Pro Tools system and obviously you need events to know where you are for that song. And so it was created that way with MIDI events from his very drums. And we recorded not in 440 hertz, but in 432 hertz, because Sasha had heard and read about that fact that, like, the planet Earth has a frequency of 8 hertz or something. And then if you multiply that upwards to use it for an instrument tuning via certain measures and whatever things you got to bear in mind in order to get that value, you come up to 432. And so we tuned everything on 432 to be in unison with, well, Earth's whatever, to be natural and whatever. And that kind of turned out very good. I mean, I think it sounds great and everything, but we were a bit surprised because harmonizing the instruments and all the necessary recordings that had to be done, like, for instance, if you take a natural piano, you can't very well go there and retune it by someone. I mean, you could, but we didn't. And so pianos and stuff like that were tuned down 8, 11% or what it is, to that value by digital means, okay? But still, I think it sounds really, really great, but we decided to abide from doing that on future productions because it simply took too long. Even though I still think it's a great effect, it's wonderful, very good sound and everything. That's mainly what took a lot of time in the production that wasn't expected, really, but yeah, whatever. And then we got a great record going with 12, 13 tracks, one spoken track, and the rest music. And so everything's a bit different. And naturally, we wanted to be a lot more heavy and fast and heavy metal and whatever, because that's been on our minds ever since we've done The Unarmed and have said to, well, the fan community that we're going to be back with a straight, mean, heavy metal album. So maybe you went on that or at that bit more extreme than usual because you said so. And yeah, that's okay. I mean, I love the result, and well, seemingly people seem to like it a lot too, seeing from all the ratings and whatever on Amazon and wherever you go, there's good ratings also with the videos and whatever's there, and looks good.
Now, Vikki, you wrote two songs on this album, one called Raise a Noise and another one called The Sage, the Fool, the Sinner. And talk about what those songs were about and what you wrote those about.
The Sage, the Fool, the Sinner is about kind of self-explanatory that you never know at whatever point you are in life, whatever you do in a certain moment, you don't know if you're acting like a sage or like a complete fool or some sinner, actually. You never know what is the outcome of your action right then. I mean, you may feel very cool, like me now here in the interview, wow, doing an interview, you know, speaking, trying to speak American and then not really achieving it. Wow, yeah, I'm happening. And, you know, there's a few people out there who actually think I'm a dick and an idiot, you know, and so that's always in the eye of the beholder, and you never actually know what you are doing, actually. So I've done that artwork with Marcus Mura, the artist for that, and he had that idea with a mirror and stuff, and I said, why don't you have the pumpkin guy look into the mirror, seeing three different personalities, because you never really know what you're up to, whatever you're doing. Or you think you're doing a good thing, and in fact, it leads to something really bad happening, so you've kind of committed a sin, which you can never tell sometimes, right in the moment. Usually everything's fine, but you know, when it hits a fan, you never know what it's going to be. And so there's one line in the lyrics that also says, you can't foretell fate, no way. Mm-hmm. But you never know what you're up to. And Raise the Noise is about a planet being occupied by a different race in space, by yet another planet, and they establish a government, be it a puppet regime or themselves, whatever. Anyways, that the planet has been deprived of their basic civil rights since generations, for a long, long time. And it's a modern planet. They have pop shows, rock shows, they go to stadiums, just like on Earth. And the occupants, they crave, they are really crazy about the music that's existing on that planet, and they really want it. They have a flaw. They faint when they get exposed to too difficult and intricate things, because their brain capacity is great. They can build spaceships for interplanetary travel, but they have that flaw, similar to, you know, lactose intolerant, or that you simply can't take alcohol. You know, it's a genetic thing. And so the citizens on that planet, they have that idea to have a flute player play to 50,000, 60,000 people in a crowd during a concert in a stadium, real intricate, complicated things, so that, well, all the listeners, you know, would faint, so they can be collected and held for ransom against the government in order to maybe possibly free the planet. And that's just like that.
Now, you talked about the response of the Unarmed album, and we talked a little bit about the new album, but, you know, the Unarmed album, that's a good, it's kind of good you went into that, because I was just curious, you know, what do you thought of the response from that record? Because even though it was a pretty well done album for what it was supposed to be, a lot of fans really did not really like that very much. A lot of fans really didn't like the new versions of the songs, and it kind of received a harsh response in the press. And, you know, what do you have to say to that? And were you surprised by the fact that there was a very harsh response to putting out the Unarmed 25th anniversary album?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. When things were set to be like that for the Unarmed, because we've merely been looking for how to do that album, how to do those recordings, the 25th anniversary album, because the band actually didn't want to be involved too much in the whole process, because we've come back from a world tour, and for instance, there is Marcus Grosskopf, the former members, never had much of some free time within 15 years or whatever, so we thought this time we can maybe afford it. And Jan Bayadi, the manager, came up with the idea to do a 25th anniversary record, because we had to, because like 25 years, come on. And we went, okay, and so how do we do it? And he said, like, Unplugged. Marcus and Neve said, no, Unplugged. At least not the way it's usually being done. Classical performances, yes, but not as Metallica have done it, or like the Chopins, I would say, the Scorpions have done. And different. And so we did. Actually, the whole process of the Unarmed took about a year, and we were not that much involved as in a typical album production, just believe me that. And I said to the manager, yeah, but, you know, if we're doing something like this, you must be aware of kind of fierce reactions and mean criticism at times. And that's why I said, you know, look, we're just doing a 25th anniversary record. We have to do it that way. We wanted to. We're proud of it. We think it's great. Apart from the children choirs and I Want Out, I really can't stand. Mm-hmm. But the rest, hey, the rest is fine. And but also at the same time, I said, you got to respect the people who say, like, it's like, what is it, abomination or whatever, and crap and bad, and they hate it and whatever. You got to respect those people. It's a matter of age and taste and whatever. And I just hope that the same very people in 20 or 30 years will maybe admit that it's great or cool or whatever, and they don't actually know what they were about when they said it's crap. But, you know, I can understand these people, certainly. You just always got to bear in mind, I'm 48, I was born 62. I went through, well, all those years, you know, with all the kind of music that was around, which was great. Well, someone born in 82 or even 91, I can understand if they can't cope with what's on the Unarmed. But I think it's a great effort, whatever. And just let it be, because it's 25th anniversary. We had to do it that way. We wanted to. And that doesn't mean we're bad heavy metal musicians, as we've just proven with, like, the Seven Sinners, you know.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the couture goes, do you guys have any plans of coming over to the U.S.?
I've seen no notification of any dates yet, but, you know, I'm pretty sure, considering the way things went last time, it was just brilliant. It was really good. We had good clubs, we had good organization, we had good accommodation and everything. Everything went just fine. And we didn't have any debts afterwards. I mean, we went on zero, and that's okay. But, hey, you know, that way we can always do more shows. And that's thanks to the guy who organized all that. He lives in Tennessee, but he's a German, and he used to work with Accept, and he knows his way in the States, and so obviously that was a good thing. So that way we can always repeat that and add more shows or whatever. I mean, that's going to be nice. So that's possible.
Now, obviously, your album is out worldwide. You have everything, you know, different formats of the album. The album's out on iTunes. And, you know, speaking of iTunes, on a lot of places, and, you know, I've never really, even when talking to you, you know, just talking to you, just, you know, on the phone or whatever like that case would be, we never really talk about this. But, you know, I'm going to ask you right now, what do you think of illegal downloading? And do you really think that it has really hurt the music industry quite a bit over the last, say, like 10 years?
Yeah, well, that's no fun no more. It's like each and every recording artist selling units, CDs, DVDs, whatever. Well, they miss out on so many sales, and it's not even funny anymore. I can tell you, it's sometimes they could be lucky if it's just a fifth of what used to get sold, just a fifth, if it comes to that at all. And so that goes for Christina Aguilera, this goes for Kylie Minogue, this goes for Michael Jackson and you know, the people who come after, and everyone. And so, you know, it's not funny. I just say this because one might come to a point where people who would have done a band or whatever would not consider this because of the mere fact that they probably won't ever get paid for their work.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that's going on, you will get a household band next door productions, you know, done by someone who has a talent to do that. But even those people, at some point, will want to get paid. And so they will go somewhere else, you know, where the money is, where they get paid for their work. And, you know, if you have, like, a talented guy inside your band who knows a little bit about mixing or whatever, because you can't possibly afford producers, real producers or mixers anymore from a certain point on, if that goes on. And so, I mean, we're really at a turning point where everybody's in the music industry is talking about this like that, you know? So we've already come to that point where it's not funny anymore, and I just wanted to state this. If it gets better in the future, it's fine, you know, as long as we can keep this up, you know, doing things with Charlie Bauerfeind, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
If it gets any less, you know, we may not be able to afford that guy anymore,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's us. We're an established band. We're great. You know, we're fine. Let's not talk about other people, you know, who didn't even make it that far,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so, whatever, I just, like, can say this very urgently. It's like, hey, it's no fun no more, really. And like, everyone, think about it, because you don't know by what means you will ever get your favorite heavy metal band in the future anymore if it's going on like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're forced to do more concerts and everything than sell T-shirts and tickets and stuff and merchandise. This is what you make your living off then later on, because, well, record sales in the form of where you could make a living, you know, do not exist as such mm-hmm. anymore as before. I can only state this. I can only say.
Now, you guys are a very good live band, especially with this new lineup. I think the band chemistry, since I've known you, is, at least in my opinion, is at its best. I mean, everybody gets along, everybody's happy on stage, and you guys have a great chemistry on stage. And, you know, speaking of that, with the digital age and with the fact that you can do almost anything you want with digital editing, do you think a lot of bands have kind of lost track of the live show? And do you think that many bands have run into this expectation that, you know, their album's great, but then when people come and see them, they can't duplicate it live? And do you think that's been a problem with a lot of bands?
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't really know. I mean, basically, I think live and let live, and let people do whatever they think is necessary to bring across the production that they've done. I mean, take a look at Muse. They used to be a three-person outfit, and then they had, like, they had an editor running, a sequencer, and now, meanwhile, they have guest musicians.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's absolutely fine. Or take a look at Fleetwood Mac. You know, they have guest musicians. That's fine. No problem. Good. No? And, you know, if you can't afford it, and then if you're going out live and you have a sequencer running, that's fine with me. It's just by means of modern times to bring across what you want. I mean, if the rest of the band is playing properly and you can see they know their stuff, I mean, why not? Why not? It's just, you know, a matter of what you get into your ear and whatever it is, and given the circumstances, I think that's just fine, you know, go for whatever you think is necessary to bring it across. And so we're living in modern times, and people don't actually care too much about how it's being achieved as long as you're not playing a full playback show, you know, with like some 16 or 24 track monster running behind the stage or underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a different thing then, yeah. I can even understand, you know, if major acts, real big acts, who have to make it or break it or whatever on a show, if they sing playback, if it has to be, you know, just to have the event happen and you know, the singer is ill and can't sing, I think even that is fine to a certain degree if that act is not doing it all the time, you know. But, I mean, we've seen those things in the press, like artist XY is not singing for real, but playback. Well, let him do that for one show. or two, if it's necessary, in order to, well, have the concert happen, really, yeah? Mm-hmm. It's better than cancel the show, because, like, the artist can sing, then that's my opinion, but, you know, everyone has a different opinion, and so that's fine. It's just for me, in order to have something take place, just do it, why not? But, well, better sing properly the next time, you know?
On the last tour, you did songs at Gamma Ray on stage. And what was it like for you to play on stage with Kai Hansen once again?
It was kind of the old family appeal. Like, with the guys of Gamma Ray, we actually all weren't aware how well we did know each other beforehand. Even though, you know, you never got to the point where you would check anything like this out. Like, you met, and you had drinks, and you had a good time. You went to see a concert or whatever, and you met, and blah, 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 blah. And the truth was evident by how much knowledge everyone had about the other already. And so then, well, there were those magic moments when Hansen and me would play Do Your Solos of Future World, and I went out, you know. Certainly, that was like the highlight of the evening. You can say that, and yeah, it was a good thing. You know.
Now, whose idea was it to start playing these songs together at the end of the show and put that tour together as far as doing the Halloween songs together at the end of the show?
Well, actually, Kai Hansen had brought that thing up more than once, and it's always been a matter of how to organize that, you know, and then to wait for the right time to actually have it happen.
Now, do you have any final words you want to say to your fans here in the United States that have been supporting you for quite a long time? Especially, you know, in this last tour, man, you guys really, really brought down the house. And there were a lot of people there to see you guys. And, you know, do you have any last words, at least some final words for your fans out here in over here in the U.S.?
Yeah, as usual. I mean, thanks for the support and whatever. And to us, it's always a great honor to be stateside, actually, and perform something, because that's not, well, the usual thing. I mean, in times like these, it comes as a hardship. And so if you make it over there because there's, in fact, enough fans to do shows, I mean, that's what I'm thankful of, what I think is cool. And, you know, it hasn't been diminished that much or whatever. There's many people to play to, and that's just great, you know. That's just good for me, and my thanks for that and for the fact that it is so. And, well, when it happens next time, I just think we got to have some great time yet again, and, well, see, this goes as long as possible, as long as it goes.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I just thought about it, I know you've only played in Cleveland once, but, you know, do you remember anything about playing in Cleveland? And if you do, what do you remember about the city?
I can just remember the Civic Center, and I would suppose it was with Ahmed St. Unriver, because I don't think it was with Amtrak. And then I just remember kind of the venue, the way it looked, and, well, I mean, those venues used to look very much alike by that time, so I actually don't know. But yeah, I just remember that our tour manager, he lived in Cleveland, so that was kind of extra, because we had some invitation, and his wife has cooked something, and so the Civic Center, I only remember, if I remember right, so you can tell me right away what kind of prick I am that I got everything wrong, or that I'm correct, you know?
Sounds good, man. Well, hey.
I thought there was a large parking lot, wasn't there?
Well,
sorry.
That's okay.